Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We invite you to listen carefully to learn about the world. And you can improve your American English reading and speaking at the same time. Today, we talk about sports and Vietnam. The country recently said thanks, but no thanks, regarding the Asian Games. We'll tell you why. Then we say happy birthday, number 450, to English writer William Shakespeare. He wrote some of the most memorable words ever put on paper. But one acting group in the United States is putting on his plays without speaking. How is that possible? Stay with us and discover our world as it is. Last week, the government in Vietnam surprised some observers with its decision not to hold the Asian Games in 2019. However, many people inside the country have welcomed the decision. Reporter Marianne Brown is in Vietnam's capital, Hanoi. June Sims has her story.
Vietnamese fans at any big football match can show lots of energy when supporting their country at international sporting events. Football generally creates the most excitement. Vietnamese often wear the colors of top teams, like Manchester United and Barcelona, on their motorbikes and clothing. But other sports like badminton are also popular. That is why the Vietnamese government's decision not to hold the 2019 Asian Games came as a surprise to many observers. One of them is Carl Thayer, a Vietnam expert from the University of New South Wales.
This is a country that likes to be a centerpiece and that is sports mad. It just surprised me because Vietnam usually has always grabbed these opportunities to showcase itself.
However, the reaction from inside the country suggests that many Vietnamese had expected the decision. In a statement last week, Prime Minister Nguyen Tan Dung said Vietnam did not have enough experience at hosting large sporting events. The statement said that hosting an international sporting event can contribute to social economic development, promoting the country's images and increasing its position. But if the event is not successful, the effects will be reversed. Hanoi won the right to host the Asian Games in 2012, beating the Indonesian city of Surabaya. But some Vietnamese criticize the expected costs. Local media have estimated the cost of holding the 2019 Games at $150 million, but some reports set the price much higher. The decision led some people to say that Vietnam was concerned about bad publicity after Russia's experience with the Winter Olympics in Sochi. But Professor Thayer does not think this was likely.
Who except for a handful of people, would be worried about the expense? Not the high-speed rail, that's an expense that the Prime Minister loses, but on the Asian Games, it would mean, circuses for the masses.
Juan Quoc Vinh is Director of International Cooperation at the Vietnam Sports Administration. He told VOA that the government has invested a lot in this area, especially in supporting young people. In his words, it is a pity Vietnam is not hosting the Asian Games. He described the feeling as being like when a football is almost inside the goal, but suddenly changes direction and finally lands outside the net. In the past, two other countries decided against the Asian Games, South Korea in 1970 and Pakistan in 1978. I'm June Sims.
This week marks the 450th anniversary of the birth of playwright William Shakespeare. An American theater company recently marked Shakespeare's birthday with a revival or new production of his play, Hamlet. But this version of the play is performed without spoken words. Katie Weaver has more.
Synetic Theater Company is based in Arlington, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. Pata Tikurashvili and his wife, Irina, launched the company 12 years ago. The Tikurashvilis moved to the United States from Georgia in the 1990s. They starred as Hamlet and Ophelia in Synetic's first silent version of Hamlet. Pata Tikurashvili says that is how the critically praised silent Shakespeare series began.
Hamlet opened the door for us in the theater community and brought us many awards and recognition. That was a start for Synetic Theater that spread the word about the theater company that we are doing Shakespeare without text, which is unusual, and same times very accessible.
The company uses music, dance, and facial expressions to tell the story. This time, Irina appeared in the play as Gertrude, Hamlet's mother. She says that Shakespearean language is widely understood and permits a lot of creativity.
We've done so many different ways, Shakespeare. We've done Shakespeare in 20s. Recently, we've done Twelfth Night, and we had also Shakespeare on Descent. It was King Lear. And we've done Tempest in the Water.
Actor Alex Mills has performed in many Synetic productions. He says playing the part of Hamlet was difficult and a huge responsibility.
You know, for Pata to pass it along to me, you know, having it been a role that he developed originally, it's kind of, in a way, feels like passing along a torch, you know, entrusting me to carry that role and the show.
The part of Ophelia was a childhood dream for 20-year-old Irina Kasajay.
My first interaction with Shakespeare was silent. Before I started reading Shakespeare on my own or in school, I saw this Hamlet for the first time. At 9 years old, I hadn't read any other Shakespeare.
Since opening in 2002, the Synetic Theater Company has received 24 Helen Hayes Awards and 92 nominations. The awards recognize theater excellence in the Washington, D.C. area. Victor Chargai is chairman of the awards committee.
What they have done for Washington Theater is really very, very important. National theater for the entire country.
In January, Washingtonian Magazine honored Pata and Irina Tikurashvili as Washingtonians of the Year for their work in the local theater community. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Whenever I think about Shakespeare, I remember the line from Hamlet, "To thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man." I have always thought it meant to be honest with yourself. What do you think it means? Send us an email or a letter with your ideas. That's all for now. But more Learning English programs are coming up. And there is world news at the beginning of the hour on VOA. The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. The United States Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, prepares young men and women to become officers in the Navy or Marine Corps. The school was established in 1845 on land where a military fort once stood. Students are called midshipmen. The Naval Academy provides undergraduates 4 years of study in 25 major areas. Degrees in science, technology, engineering, or mathematics are especially popular. Many Naval Academy graduates have become important American leaders. Former President Jimmy Carter, for example, was a midshipman. Senator John McCain, a former presidential candidate, also graduated from the school. Foreign students also attend the Naval Academy. Currently, there are about 60 of them. David Ochi is from Panama. He notes some difficulties with life in a new country.
Leaving the comfort zone of your country to come here to a culture and language completely different from your own and adapt has been a challenge.
Student Santiago Gonzalez Ayer of Spain says the academy has helped him feel more a part of a new culture.
It opens a cultural horizon so that one understands American culture better and is more involved in the culture.
The Naval Academy says its job is to develop a student's skills, character, and understanding of others. International Program Director Tim Disher says the U.S. Navy gains from the Academy's acceptance of foreign students. He says this is especially true in a world increasingly connected through technology. Tim Disher graduated from the Naval Academy in 1981. He says at that time, only top officers worked with foreign officers and foreign navies. But he says this is no longer true.
We're a smaller Navy, and our students, even as midshipmen, have an ability to make an impact with our foreign partners. We are creating young ambassadors right off the bat, right after they get commissioned.
He says the exchange program also helps American midshipmen understand the wider world. Paul Angelo graduated from the Academy in 2006. He praises the foreign exchange program.
It's important that our allies know exactly how we function and operate as a military.
Midshipman Gonzalez Ayer plans to return to Spain and serve as a naval officer after finishing at the Naval Academy. David Ochi wants to work as an ocean engineer when he goes home to Panama. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. Visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com to test your English language skills with our quizzes. You can also comment on our programs there. Or send us an email to learningenglish@voanews.com. And remember to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. I'm Bob Doty. ¶¶
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. In November of 1840, the American people elected William Henry Harrison as their 9th president. Harrison was a retired general and a well-known Indian fighter. Many people considered him a hero for his victory over Native Americans at the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811. Americans elected John Tyler as Harrison's vice president. The two men ran on the campaign slogan, Tippecanoe and Tyler too. Harrison was the first president from the Whig Party. Some Whig leaders, including Senators Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, believed they could control the newly elected president. Harrison asked Daniel Webster to edit the speech he planned to give after the swearing-in ceremonies. Webster removed some material from the inaugural speech and suggested other changes. The inauguration took place on March 4th, 1841. It was the coldest inaugural day in the nation's history. Harrison spoke on the front steps of the Capitol building. He gave the longest inaugural address of any president. It lasted almost 2 hours. But Harrison did not wear a winter overcoat or hat. He got sick, probably from standing so long outside in the cold. Rest was his best treatment. But the new president was so busy, he had little time to rest. Harrison's health grew worse. Late in March 1841, he developed pneumonia. Doctors did everything they could to cure him, but nothing seemed to help. On April 4th, exactly 1 month after he became president, William Henry Harrison died. Vice President John Tyler was then at his home in Williamsburg, Virginia. Daniel Webster, the new Secretary of State, sent his son on horseback to tell Tyler of the president's death. The vice president was shocked. He had not even known that Harrison was sick. 2 hours after he received the news, Tyler was on his way to Washington. There was some question about Tyler's official duties. Harrison's death marked the first time that a president had died in office. No one was sure what the Constitution meant when it said that the powers of a deceased president should go to the vice president. Eventually, Tyler, Webster, and other cabinet members decided that Tyler should be president and serve until the next election.
That was a very controversial claim because people said, no, he's not the president, he's an acting president. He's just temporarily filling the office, but he's not president.
Historian Michael Holt taught at the University of Virginia. He says, although not everyone supported John Tyler's claim, he set an important example. He showed how power could transfer peacefully to the vice president after a U.S. president died in office. Tyler was sworn in as the nation's 10th president on April 6th, 1841. He was 51 years old. No other man had become president at such an early age. Tyler was a slaveholding Southerner. He was born and grew up in the same part of Virginia as William Henry Harrison. His father was a wealthy landowner and judge who had been a friend of Thomas Jefferson. Tyler completed studies at the College of William and Mary and became a lawyer. He entered politics and served in the Virginia State Legislature. Then he was elected a member of Congress and later governor of Virginia. He also served as a member of the United States Senate. Tyler believed strongly in the rights of the states. As a congressman and a senator, he had voted against every attempt to give more power to the federal government. In fact, historian Michael Holt says that in many ways, Tyler was more like a member of the Democrats, the opposing party at the time.
He favored the typical position of Democrats on what we could call domestic policy, which is that government is best which governs least. The less federal domestic policy you have trying to generate economic growth or improve society or whatever, the better.
In comparison, many Whig Party members firmly supported the ideas of a national bank, a protective tax on imports, and federal spending to improve transportation in the states. Tyler was just as firmly against these ideas. At the same time, many Democrats did not like the president either.
Most Democrats regarded him as a traitor who had jumped from the Jackson Party and joined the Whigs, however temporarily.
Michael Holt says even Tyler's appearance made him seem difficult and unpleasant.
You look at this guy and he's sort of aesthetically thin and with sunken cheeks and a long pointed nose. He just looks like he's unhappy with the world.
President Tyler quickly became even more unpopular over the issue of a new national bank. He wanted to establish such a bank in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The national bank could open offices in a state, but only if the state approved. Tyler's proposal was not the kind of bank most Whigs in Congress supported. They wanted no limits of any kind on the power of a national bank to open offices anywhere in the country. Whigs in Congress suggested a compromise. Bank offices would be permitted in any state where the state legislature did not immediately refuse permission. But President Tyler vetoed the compromise. He sent the bank bill back to Congress. The congressman wrote another bill. They said it was exactly what the president wanted. But the president did not agree. He said the states must have the right to approve or reject bank offices. He said this second bill would also be vetoed unless changes were made in it. The changes were not made, and Tyler did as he said he would do. He vetoed it. The decision created a crisis in the cabinet. All the president's advisors but one, Daniel Webster, resigned. Michael Holt says that several days later, most cabinet members and a large group of other Whig congressmen voted to expel Tyler from the party.
They read this paper saying he's no Whig. Don't blame us for all of his vetoes.
Harrison appointed a new cabinet of Whigs he hoped would be more friendly to him, But after a while, they too resigned. Michael Holt says Tyler made more changes in his cabinet than any other U.S. president. President Tyler struggled with his party over other issues. One was about import taxes. 2 years into Tyler's presidency, the government found itself short of money. It was spending more than it had. Congress decided that import taxes should be raised, some even higher than 20%. But President Tyler vetoed the bill. He said it was wrong to raise the tax so high and, at the same time, continue to give the states money from land sales. He said the federal government itself needed the land sale money. Michael Holt says once again the Whigs were angry. Their party controlled both houses of Congress and the White House, but they could not reach their goals.
The Whigs were elected with this agenda that they wanted Congress to pass, that they had promised would rescue the country from a very serious depression. And this included a new national bank, higher tariffs, distribution of federal revenues from public land sales.
President Tyler, he adds, frustrated the entire Whig legislative program. It was clear the Whigs would not nominate him for the next election, so Tyler turned his attention to the Democrats. He hoped they would ask him to be their presidential candidate in 1844. Tyler began appointing Democratic advisors to his cabinet, and he gave his support to one of the Democrats' causes, making Texas a state in the Union. Texas was an independent nation at the time. Some Americans wanted to bring Texas into the United States to further expand the country. But others were afraid that the territory would permit slavery. They wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler had the opposite fear. Michael Holt explains that Tyler was afraid that Texas would remain an independent republic and abolish slavery there.
He and other Southerners thought that that was a terrible idea. But he also believed that this is what's going to put him in the history books, that he's going to be responsible for adding this enormous Republic of Texas, although it wasn't quite as big as what they claimed, to the United States.
The election of 1844 and the question of Texas statehood will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.